Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach, our first program of this week. It's the only program we do this week, but I think in the spirit of all headlines and anything having to do with the market or the economy, we should try to make records wherever we can. So record-breaking, first time this week ever, our program starts. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Generally speaking, it's Jake McClure and Jeff McClure. The Jeff McClure being the elder bald one, while Jake McClure being the younger bald one. I am the younger bald one, Jake himself. Jeff will be joining us, hopefully, if the phone line's permitting. He'll be calling in. But let me go ahead with the disclosures while we're waiting on that. The disclosures. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. What does that mean? Well, this is a radio program. That was called a emphatic pause, in case you didn't realize you were listening to a radio program. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm based out of Salado, Texas. Now, just because it's registered with the SEC, our firm is registered with the SEC, doesn't mean that the SEC has approved us in any way. That's just our regulatory authority. The radio program is separate. It's a separate thing from investment advice. We give education on the air. We give investment advice in person. It would, unless you were talking about an extremely broad case, investment advice can't be given on the air. And when you give investment advice in a really broad way, it's called education. So what does that mean? Investment advice has to be tailored to you individually. And if I could do that on the radio, I'd be so wealthy that nobody would be able to afford me. But I can't. So we're going to educate. We're going to say these are the decision-making points. This is what you should think about when asking yourself these questions about fill in the blanks. So we don't get paid to do this radio program. That is a thing people are a little surprised about. We also don't pay to do the radio program. Another thing people are very surprised about when we talk to them. We do it as a public service. Now, we advertise and we even pay for advertisement during the week on this radio station, KTEM 1400. But we use the advertisement 100% to advertise the radio program. We see this as a public service. And yes, we get benefit from it. That is something that, you know, if you're a YouTube personality and you say, I'm not taking an endorsement from, you still get compensation for your time. We don't get direct compensation for what we're doing here. We get indirect. In fact, quite a few of you that are listening to me right now are clients of our firm. And that means that we're able to have communication with you, even if it's one-sided, although a lot of our clients call in or email in as well. And what that says is that we get benefit from this. But the benefit that we're giving, we hope, is much greater than the benefit we're getting. It doesn't make us unhappy when we get benefit out of it. It's just something that's it's a nice little bonus. It's not something that we decided, let's do this so that we can get ultra wealthy. If anybody's ever been in this studio, they would realize that the possibility of getting ultra wealthy in a local AM radio station, there was a time in the 1920s. This is the 2020s, though. So on the line, we have someone who has just called in. That is hopefully Elder Baldy, Jeff McClure himself. And I'm going to do the microphone transmission transition. And here we go.
Is that you on the line?
This is the you. No, this is the ram.
You are not a female sheep. You are not a bellwether. That would be
I'm not a bellwether. I'm not a weather, and I'm not a you.
Let me throw that out there. Bellwether. People use that in the market all the time. Bellwether is the sterilized male sheep, a sterilized ram that leads the sheep around with a bell around its neck. I not sure why people think it's a good thing to call each other, but I guess, hey, you've been a bellwether all day. Well, thank you, I think.
Well, it's a nice way of saying leader, but it also infers some other things.
Yeah, there's some pretty severe, like your little dinghy. You have no possibility of ever creating offspring, but, you know, it's a good compliment.
I mean, if we have bulls and bears in the market,
mm-hmm.
and supposedly investors are like sheep,
that
and
doesn't...
they all go in one direction and they stampede and spook, I suppose you could have bellwethers.
Yeah, why not? We already have a first question through email. I haven't even given out the email addresses. So it's like people are regular listeners or something. If you would like to ask us questions, the phone lines in here are cutting edge, 1930s technology. So we only have one, and Elder Baldy Jeff is using it at the moment. So if you would like to join the conversation, we have our email open. If you would like to email Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com, we are taking questions and attempting to answer them. So, first question, do you mind if we jump into that, or do you want to go into the market first?
Well, let's get the question out of the way.
Okay. Listener John emailed in with a picture of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal, which is very meta, because you can go online and get the electronic version, but why do that when you can get the picture version, which is electronic, of the paper version? That's what they should put out, I think. They should just take pictures of the paper. Anyway.
I think they actually have one.
The question is, article in today's Wall Street Journal. And let me see. Investors bet on volatility, making markets even wilder, is the headline. And he says, PwC says it's institutional traders that drive the market and not the individuals. And by PwC, I believe he means personal wealth coach.
Now, it could be Price Waterhouse.
Or it could be personal watercraft. Jet skis are pretty awesome. We say that it's the institutional traders that drive the market and not the individuals. How much of an impact are these day traders making on the day-to-day volatility? And this is a great question. It's one that I spent some time tutoring on yesterday. So I think it's fantastic that this is the question. It depends on the amount of trades that are taking place on a given day in a given stock. So what does that mean? We measure that in volume, not as in radio volume. That's just getting louder. But by the amount of people making trades, the more people that are buying or selling or both in a given stock, the less impact a day trader has in that environment. There are stocks that they have nicknames. They're called pink sheets or penny stocks, or there's lots and lots of names for them, that have very, very low volume. We call those shallow traders. There's a lot of other names for them too. One trade in that stock, when there's maybe one trade a month in that stock, can have a very big impact on the stock price. So it depends on what they're trading. The penny stocks don't have a big impact on the whole market, because if we think about how the S&P is calculated, it's 500 stocks. It's what the 500 stands for, although sometimes there's a little more than 500 and sometimes a little less. The S&P 500 is supposed to be 500 stocks. There's a lot of companies in there that we know the names of, and a lot of companies in there that most of us have never heard of. The ones that we've never heard of have less impact on the movement of the market than the ones we have heard of. So that's an important factor. The bigger you are, the more impact you have on the market, because your movement is averaged in based on your size, not just averaged in based on your price. That's called capitally weighted, which doesn't make a lot of sense, because that means it's weighted by head. Okay. But it means you're weighted by size. It's a weighted ratio in the S&P 500. So a day trader, if it's a hedge fund, suddenly becomes an institutional investor. And institutional investors are the long-term movers of the market, but you can see this if you go back through the years in the middle of summer. We talk about this on the program quite a bit in summer. When there's nothing big going on, and so the senior guys and gals are all out on vacation, there's not a lot of volume in the market. The stock trading drops way, way down. And that means that a few big trades can move the market drastically. So I wish there was a simple answer to say that day traders either do or don't have an effect on the market, but the reality is that it depends on the day and the volume and how many day traders there are. The benefit of having people that are day trading, we don't recommend it. We think it's extremely dangerous. I've known some people that have been very profitable doing it over a long period of time. I've also known a lot more people that have lost a lot of money over a long period of time. The benefit is that most people, when they buy into their 401k, they're not interested in selling the next day. The vast majority of people are buy and hold investors. But occasionally, you hit a point where you're ready to do that thing you've been planning for 20 years, whether that's build a house or get a nice bass boat. Although if you've been planning on a bass boat for 20 years, that is an incredible deal of fortitude. You have really stuck to it. But you take a big withdrawal to buy your boat or your house. Well, where does that money come from? Somebody's got to buy it from you. And if the vast majority of people are buy and hold, and they buy according to when their 401k gets funded, who's there to buy your stock when you go to sell it so that you can buy the boat? And that, quite often, is the day trader. And over time, the day traders eventually sell that stuff off to the buy and hold people. But it's a functional version of volatility. They add to volatility by selling a lot on days and buying a lot on days, because the majority of people aren't buying and selling on a given day. It's the margin. It's the few people that are buying and selling that set the price. So I think that was a really long-winded answer. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, the volatility trade is mainly done, despite what the article said, I'm familiar with the article, I read it this week, is mainly done, and it indicates in the article, it's mainly done by institutions. There are a lot of day traders, and their total volume right on the day trades are significant. Now,
there's another story on hedge funds betting on market volatility indexes, and that's important.
It is increasing volatility in certain areas. For example, it is the small amateur day traders. When I say small amateur, these people sometimes are trading millions of dollars, but they're considered small on the New York Stock Exchange. Hertz, the rental car company,
right,
is bankrupt. It's in Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Yep.
But its stock price has been seesawing up and down as much as 37% a day because people are buying the stock and then selling it. It's worthless, effectively. It was at 56 cents a share.
It's up to like $3.47 now.
Yeah, and it's bouncing around, and it's kind of like Bitcoin.
Well, they just said that they were going to offer $1 billion in additional stock from the Treasury, which will dilute the existing owners, and maybe that would be enough to get them out of bankruptcy. And
the interesting point is they're going to have to put, they've offered in their filing with the SEC to make this offering. They've said they're going to put on there that the stock may be worthless.
Yeah.
And yet they expect to get $1 billion of people buying the stock and get them out of bankruptcy. If it works, the stock, it might be worth the deal. But the point is, buying stock in a bankrupt company where the only thing they want to do by selling stock is pay off some of their debt.
Yeah, and this, they don't really have a return to profit idea, because would you like to sit in a rental car right now?
Well, Hertz was headed to bankruptcy before
COVID. Yeah,
and it is a company that has not figured out how to compete with Uber yet, and isn't doing a very good job. It's probably, with the rest of the rental car companies, is probably on the way out the door.
And Uber might be too, which would be an interesting vacuum left over if
something will take over in place of it. But eventually, with self-driving cars, I think it'll be a completely new world. But the point is, volatility, what the article, driving stocks haywire, it's not affecting the index, it's not affecting major stocks, but Hertz is still traded on the New York Stock Exchange, even though there's a move, the process of delisting is underway. And it is affecting the volatility of some small stocks, small dollar-wise stocks, particularly those in bankruptcy. A lot of day traders are in there buying and selling. It's like Bitcoin. There's no earnings. There's probably no rational explanation for why people would buy or sell. You can't look at the cash flows. You can't look at anything and determine what the stock is worth. It's purely it went up, so I bought some.
Right. This is, in my opinion, this is called derivative trading. From the perspective of the people making the trades in Hertz, they don't care about Hertz, the company itself. They don't want to own Hertz. They're buying these units of a thing so that they can sell them if they move up. It doesn't matter if it's Hertz or something else. It's gambling. Yeah.
It's simply rolling the dice and thinking maybe I'll be smarter than the other guy.
And we get spikes of this in every big market volatility area. And at the beginning, a lot of the day traders make a lot of money. But the longer they do it, the more likely they are to lose money because the volatility goes the other direction as well. And that's one of the things about steep downturns is that it's like bull markets in reverse. There are people that short stocks. There are people that buy stocks that they know are worthless to sell them to other people for more money. There are people that sell stock because they think the price is going to go down, and people that borrow stock to sell because they think the prices are going to go down. And that works really well until it doesn't. And the people that are caught with their hands still in the cookie jar, when the cookie jar is launched into the volcano, that's what happens at the end of bankruptcies, is that there's nothing left. If they go fully through bankruptcy, the company's gone.
Well, I think it's a very good story in the article on Hertz about a guy who started off trading Hertz with $3 million, which apparently was most of what he had to trade, which indicates he's not, by my definition, a small investor, but by Wall Street's definition, he is. And he was down to $500,000 pretty quickly, and he's trying to make it back now.
Well, you know how to make a small fortune in the market.
Start with a large one.
Yeah. That's how day traders make their small fortunes. There are day traders that are long-term profitable, but they are rare, extremely rare. In fact, this is a challenge we've put out for many years, and we haven't said it in a long time. I would love to hear from you if you've been day trading for 7 to 10 years and you feel like you're doing a really good job. Not to request your business because we don't do day trading, but to talk. Because the vast majority of people that I have spoken to that do day trading, the vast majority of the surveys out there about day trading say that most people that do it don't make a living doing it. They lose money doing it long term. Now, there are exceptions. The professionals are in some ways called day traders, but if you think about who they are, they're not really day traders. So Warren Buffett is not a day trader. He may trade in a day, but he wants to buy the company, not some derivative of the company. He wants to be part of the ownership of that company. It's a very different form of investing. It's true investing.
I've said this before, and I followed a semi-professional day trader, a guy who was retired, but a significant amount of money in the market. He was using, when I was a broker, he used me as a broker. And today he'd probably use an online broker, but he used me as a broker, and I discounted pretty dramatically to where he was paying next to nothing because I wanted to watch him. And I visited him in his house in Houston, and he had, you've been down there too, I think.
I was a young teenager when I went with you.
He had screens of all kinds of indicators that would indicate when he should buy and sell and when he should old, and I tracked him. He bought a mutual fund through our office, and I tracked if he just hung on to that original mutual fund and never traded in and out of it. If he just bought that fund and stayed there. And he actually was a market timer, and I tracked it over about a 10-year period, and he would have multiplied his money many times because it was a high, it was a pretty good growth fund. He would have done very, very well over the period that I was able to follow him had he just bought that fund and never sold it. He actually wound up with a gain, which he lost twice, and the third time he lost it, he gave up. And what happens is when the thing started down and he bailed out of it, it turned right around and went back up, and he got back into it and lost a lot of money. And I've never seen a day trader, never a market timer, which day traders in many ways are, who actually made money. I've sure met a bunch of them that have lost money. They don't like to talk about it, but they've lost money.
That's kind of like gambling in Vegas. Everybody wins money in Vegas. You just generally lose it again afterwards. You don't build billion-dollar casinos by losing money to everybody that comes to gamble in them. Those casinos were built on you losing to them.
As a matter of fact, your probabilities of the longer you play whatever machine or game that you're playing in Vegas, the longer you play, the higher the probability of a loss.
And there are exceptions to that, the ones that are based more on skill than luck. And I realized that there was a hidden moron in there. I like poker, and I've won some money at poker. Poker's fun. There's skill involved, and it's not weighted toward any person playing poker except for the dealer, who gets paid no matter who wins. So from the perspective of poker, it's possible, if you're a professional poker player, to have a long-term good stream of income. But where does it come from? And this is the same thing when we talk about day traders. In order for a day trader to make money, somebody has to lose money. And we look at that, that's called speculation. We look at it as speculation. And when we consider an investor, in order for an investor to make money, other people have to make money too. They have to provide something that people are willing to buy and feel like it's a good deal in buying. Everybody has to win for a long-term investor to work out. That's not necessarily true in real estate. It's not true in poker. It's not true in commodities. It is true when you have a value creation type of business. If you're creating something that people want to pay you for, then everybody needs to win for you to make a profit. And most people do in long term. That's why the stock market has been profitable, because they provide things to people that they want to buy and at a reasonable price.
Yeah, that's what I was going to contrast, is that it's a person who's doing speculation, day trading, or market timing. The only way they make money is if somebody else loses money. But a long-term investor and the day trader and the market timer, the longer they stay in, and statistically, there may be exceptions to this, but, and I've never met one, but statistically, the longer they stay in, the more likely they are to lose money. Longer they keep doing, because the longer they keep day trading, or the longer they keep market timing. Whereas a long-term investor who gets something good and hangs on to it as long as the criteria that he bought it for, or she bought it for, remain, and only sell it when the selling criteria click in, the longer they're invested, the more likely they are to make money. And there's a world of difference there.
Agreed.
Speaking of which, we probably ought to talk about the market.
Let's do it.
Well, the S&P 500 was nice and stable through Wednesday, slowly rising, and then Thursday, it panicked. It spooked, which is something, I guess, that the sheep would do if the bellwether suddenly got scared. It dropped about 6% on Thursday, came back about 1.3% on Friday. So what we have is it's down 5.86% year to date, and it down 4.78% for the week. And what happened on Thursday? Well, what happened on Thursday? Now, there are other states have come out in the past, Arizona and Utah particularly, and have reported an increase in hospitalizations and a pretty dramatic increase in number of coronavirus cases. Florida came out with the news, and all of that just kind of went under the bridge and nobody cared too much about it. Texas is a big enough piece of the economy that when something happens in Texas, people pay attention. And we've been mentioning the fact that the coronavirus cases in Texas have been rising and appear to be accelerating for a couple of weeks now. But in this particular case, well, what they were saying is, well, we're testing more people, therefore the cases are rising, and it really doesn't mean that there's more people with coronavirus in Texas. But there's a gold standard now for the coronavirus pandemic, and that is hospitalization. And when somebody noted, there was an article actually on Thursday in the Wall Street Journal that noted that the hospitalizations in Texas were up 42% since the end of last month. And you take
less 42%, than 2 weeks. Yeah.
You take a 42% jump in hospitalizations, and you say that's not because there's more testing. That's literally 42% more people in the hospital that have been said, hey, you got coronavirus and it's bad enough. We need to let you into the hospital. We need to admit you. That looks like a surge that was unpredicted, and it's kicking up a little bit of fear in the market. And the fear is there, and it's very legitimate. Every major pandemic in our history has had a second wave. And in other words, you have an initial wave where there's a lot of infections, and then people begin to distance themselves, and without the government ever telling them to do so, they're afraid of it. They begin to behave as though they're afraid of it. And it dies down, and then they think, well, it's gone. And then they start getting back together again, and it surges back up. And the problem with human behavior here is the time frame between people getting together and the surge in new cases is generally about a month.
Yeah.
I know it's a two-week incubation period, but the problem is that it's being passed around from one person to another.
Right.
And what we're seeing is people started about a month ago, coming out of lockdown and not wearing masks and clustering together. Jake and I both have seen recently people clustering together and in restaurants and entertainment areas, not wearing masks and basically ignoring the social distancing. And apparently that's going on all over the state. And it's particularly strong.
It's not just here. It's in California, too.
Right. It's in the states where the coronavirus wasn't severe. Now, apparently people in New York are still doing a pretty good job of social distancing because they got burned.
Yeah, they were scared. A lot of people knew people that got sick or died.
So we had about a 4.78% drop in the market this week. That leaves it down about 5.86% year to date. It's down 10% from its high in February. The important thing to remember as you look at this is it's still up almost 36% from its bottom in late March. And I think it's a good reflection of reality because I think there is a distinct possibility, and the market has just priced in a possibility that people will ignore the warnings and not maintain their discipline, and we will have a second wave, and it'll hit it primarily in the areas that did not get hit last time. I was looking at the 1918 flu, and the first wave deaths were in, oddly enough, New York City,
yeah.
Big time.
It's not odd. It's a big concentration of people all stuck together and with a lot of traveling that goes on.
Right. A lot of basically it was on the East Coast, and then it died down, and then it came back again, and it came back again in the hinterlands. It came back again in the states away from New York with lower population densities. And the second wave was actually more deadly than the first one. Now, is that going to happen this time? Nobody knows. It all depends on whether we pay attention, we wear a mask, we social distance, we avoid clustering together and staying in groups. But it doesn't look like we're doing that. And whether or not our behavior will change because of these numbers, I don't think people are paying much attention to the numbers.
I would couch that a little differently.
Okay.
We're not growing the infection rate in Texas or in California or in North Carolina or in any of the other places that are having this increase at the rate we did at the beginning, even in those places.
Sure, that's true.
So Texas at the beginning, back at mid-March, went from close to zero cases to 600 some odd cases in a very short period of time. So that is a spread that is exponential. It's logarithmic. There's no way, if that continued, that everybody in the state wouldn't get sick. We're not back there. We've had an increase, and when I look at the increase, it's kind of stair-stepping slowly, which means those stair steps, and this is anybody that looks at any graph on any newspaper right now, Wall Street Journal has them occasionally, Washington Post, New York Times, basically USA Today, you've got these weird step-up, step-downs that are happening, these little ripples on the top. Those are infection rates. If somebody gets an infection on a Friday, they may be passing it during a time period, and the people that are sick with last week's infection rates are starting to get better. Well, you may be passing it, but it may be a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the person gets sick from it. So you get this repeated pattern of ups and downs. And are they rising or are they falling? And our hospitalization rate in the country is still falling. There are some hotspots. California and Texas, you know, those are not one. Texas has been kind of front page in a lot of areas. But California and Texas, if we just start mapping with infection rate rather than hospitalization, or just go right down to hospitalization rate and start counting from today, the two big leaders right now are, well, three, we'll go to three, are California, Texas, and Florida. So these are across the spectrum politically. It isn't like it's just liberal places or Republican places. It's not like big cities or small cities. This portion of the pandemic is about person-to-person spread out of dense populations. So the political divide that we saw early on here about whether to open up or whether to close was based on demographics. Most dense population areas, cities, are mostly liberal. Rural populations are mostly conservative. You can throw that to a political party. And as long as they didn't set in stone their political beliefs and their pandemic beliefs, we might have a big coming together of beliefs in the near future. To tell people on both sides, from the people that they listen to be careful. But because at the beginning it was so concentrated in urban areas, which are liberal, there's a real political divide now, where the Democrats, which mostly live in urban areas, and the Republicans, which mostly live in rural or suburban areas, Republicans didn't see a lot of transmission, where the Democrats did. And so as long as they're not entrenched in political lines, we're seeing the reverse of that now. Yeah, it's still bigger in big cities, but meatpacking plants are not generally in big cities. And some of the hottest spots in Texas are deep in outside of any town, deep outside of any big city. They're little towns. And that's the danger, is that if we entrenched politically and said it's a Republican thing now to say the COVID is not a big deal, and the Democrats are saying it's politically our battlefield or whatever, we could have a problem. Because arguments tend to last beyond the point that the thing you're arguing about is even reasonable anymore. And you can apply that in your own personal relationships as much as you can to politics. But we usually argue about things way after they're important. But that doesn't mean we're less angry about them.
We haven't talked much in the past few weeks about the 10-year Treasury note yields or curve, but I think it's worth looking at.
Yeah, let's do it.
The yields grew a bit more pessimistic. They dropped 21%, and they closed at 0.706%, which, for reference, last week they were closing up near 1% for the 10-year Treasury note. It's down to 0.7% now. That's a big drop. It was 0.9-something last week. And the Treasury, the 10-year Treasury yield, is a forecast by the people who trade 10-year U.S. Treasuries as to what economic activity there will be over the next decade. And the lower the yield on the 10-year Treasury note, the more pessimistic the traders are. They're saying, in essence,
low interest means there'll be low demand for borrowing, which means that there'll be a lot of people wanting to put their money in treasuries and do the treasury trade, which means low interest are just fine. They're forecasting, in essence, low inflation. They're forecasting relatively low economic activity. Now, that's a negative. The positive, though, is that we have a very, very, very firmly positive yield curve. In other words, the longer the maturity of the treasury security we're talking about, going all the way from 30 days out to 30 years, the longer the maturity, the higher the interest rate. That is a forecast by the treasury market. They don't gather together and say, let's bet on what's going to happen 30 years from now. But the more steep the yield curve is, unless somebody is manipulating it, the more the consensus is among bond traders who have a lot of skin in the game that we will see a better economic in the future. The United States economic situation will be better in the future than it was in the past. And we have a steep yield curve. To put that in perspective, a year ago, we had an inverted yield curve. The bond market, the Treasury yield curve, was effectively predicting a recession to be going on right now. Did it have some prescience and know that the coronavirus was coming? No. Otherwise, the interest rates would be a lot lower. But we were due for a recession, and the coronavirus happened to hit just at the point where we were due for a recession, which is certainly not a pleasant thing, but it's the way it works out. But the yield curve, it's important to keep your eye on something. And that is that the yield curve is saying a year or so from now, the economy should be in better shape than it is today. It's not going to be going like gangbusters. It won't be racing red hot like it was in the 90s or even as it probably was in 2019. But it is going to be the yield curve is forecasting, based on all the information we have, that a year from now to 18 months from now, things will be a lot better. And that is a real positive note. It's a good idea to keep your eye on that. The other forecast device that sometimes gets out of whack is oil. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is one of the benchmarks, it's called WTI, it dropped 6.31% for the week, closing out the week at $36.50. It was up near $40. It's still down 40% year to date. So what it's telling us is it's no longer trading near zero, which indicates the economy is headed towards collapse. It's trading at $36.50, which is a price at which many oil producers can actually make a little bit of a profit. But it's forecasting that things will be better in the future and that demand for oil is up. And all you have to do is get on I-35 and see that the demand is up. It's important to look at these longer-term indicators and try to keep your eyes off the short-term panics and spooks. At least that's our opinion.
I agree. And we have to play some commercials, though they appear to both be public service announcements. The online version might actually have some for-profits in there. We will play those and be back on the other side. If you'd like to contact us about questions for us to answer, that sort of thing, we've got our email open at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Wow.
Actually did that.
We did it, sort of. Yeah. Trying to get the microphones set in here and so that I can hear you and you can hear everybody. It's a little bit of a trick. And this studio is it's a bit of a ghost town every weekend, so I brought my hammer this time in case something broke. I'll fix the electronics very carefully.
Do they all look like nails?
Everything looks like nails right now. I have a hammer.
Cool.
Yeah. You nailed that one, sir. You nailed it.
I nailed it.
Yeah.
That was good. Nailed it well.
Hey. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Okay. I wanted to bring up something. I started last month talking about, or the month before, It's all blurring together at this point, about sales tax in Texas. And looking at Bell County, and because Bell County is where we are when we're doing this broadcast, it's where our office is located. Looking at Texas in general, sales tax revenue for April. So, well, I guess for May now, we've got the June report out. I'm looking at June's report, which is about May. May from last year in May was down 11.1% in sales tax. So that's a nice little interesting tidbit. The entirety of sales tax revenue for the state of Texas is down 11% year over year. We're still positive over a 12-month period, over the last 12-month period, because we had a boom at the beginning of this. Okay, so Bell County. What's going on in Bell County? This is something that is fascinating to me. Percent change year over year, so May of last year to May of this year, we have some big, big winners in Bell County during a pandemic. How could this be? Well, this is the meat that economists love. I'm going to tell you some places where sales tax revenue is down. So Belton is down about 0.5% from last year at this point. That's not going to cause Belton to go bankrupt. Salado is down almost 8%. That's not good. 8% sales revenue drop for the village is not great. Temple is down less than 1% from a year ago. Troy is down 17%. So what is that about? Okay, so those are all the bad news in Bell County. Good news. Harkerites is up by 0.5%. Holland is up by 52%. 52% more sales this May than last May. Now, we're still only talking about a payment to the state of $6,258. But it's fascinating because people are at home. Holland is a suburb. Most people that live in Holland don't work there. But they've been staying there and eating there and getting little bits of grocery there. And so that's in the little towns, their revenue is up. Morgan's Point is up 17%. Little River Academy was up 21%. Killeen was up almost 6%. Nolanville was up 29%. And Rogers was up 17%. So what that means is all the little places that are usually just places where people sleep have been more than where they sleep lately. We're seeing a strange phenomena that I didn't expect to occur until self-driving cars got rid of traffic as we know it. And that is that you don't have to buy everything in the city, that you can buy the things that you need at home. When I say about self-driving cars, and we've been talking about this, you and I, on the way to the studio, I had Elder Baldy on the phone. We have these kind of breathing demographic shifts in the United States where people swarm to the big cities for industrialization. So think of early 20th century. Everybody runs to the city. They leave the farm. Industrialization is getting rid of jobs on the farm, so you go to the city to work in an industrial plant. So they crowd into the cities, and inner cities get huge renovations. They are these glittering spectacles of awe. And people look at the inner city and they say, wow, that's an amazing place. Followed by some other mode of technology that causes people to go to the suburbs. In the case of the 1900s, the 20th century, it was really the telephone. It was also good driving conditions where you could live in the suburbs and drive into the city. And over time, more and more of the businesses moved closer to the suburbs until the inner city was not a glowing thing that people looked at and said, wow, wouldn't you love to go live in the inner city? It turned into war zones and looting and fires and centers of crime. And then you have gentrification, which is a new term for making the inner city glow again, because there's a rush in tech to get close together with everybody so that you can make this new technology and be intensely profitable. So the rush to the inner city comes on, inner city Dallas, Austin, Houston, New York, it doesn't matter. All of the slums are turned into beautiful, glittering awe again. And then the next technology wave will happen. And that's where we are now. At some point, we'll have another technology wave that says we don't have to live in the inner city to work there. Whether that means we commute longer distances with less traffic because all the cars are driving themselves, or we get the ability to remotely commute in a way that is, or remotely work in a way that is, up till the recent coronavirus issue, something that looked way too complicated. Well, people are making it simpler now. So we may be seeing the beginning ripple of something that's going to last for the next 30 years, where we see the cities go back to places that nobody really wants to live, and you want to have some property way out in the country, so long as you have good internet connection. We'll talk to SpaceX about that. There's the networks of satellites that will be up in rural area. It won't matter if you're in the middle of the desert or the middle of the city. If you can see the sky, you'll have an internet connection. They're not going to be the only ones doing it. So that was my quick futuristic look at some of the minor changes that might turn major in the near future.
Well, that's one of the things that I've read some articles about, particularly in the California area. Some of the major corporations out there, including Apple, are looking really, really hard at having more people work from home. And the reason is, not only does it means they can expand without expanding their buildings, but also
keeps overhead low, that's for sure.
It keeps the overhead low, but the average, the typical commute from home to Apple's actual facility where people work is 90 minutes right now.
Yeah.
One way. And if you can shave that.
You're breaking up really bad. We may have lost you. If you can shave 90 minutes
twice a day off of a commute, that's 3 hours. And if you can make that productive time or family time, then you're ahead, hugely ahead. That is a vastly more profitable for everybody. The family life is important. I think Elder Baldy's calling back in. Let's see.
Are you there?
Yep.
All right.
I'm there. Apparently, the mysterious glitch of the cell phone got between me and you.
Well, you know, we didn't knock on any wood when we were talking about the technology revolution that's going on right now, where anyone, anywhere can remotely commute into the radio studio. Never mind. No, we can't do that.
Yeah, well.
Just ironic, the timing there.
Getting the right software becomes very, very important. I have an internet system here that works through the computer. I have a telephone system that works through the computer. And the quality is less than perfect, and the lag is a real killer. So we're going to have to improve on that. And I think we will. It's one of the disadvantages of living in a small town at the end of an antiquated cable system that was put in 1846 for people to knock rocks together or something. It's a joke, obviously. But it doesn't transmit as well as some others do. And I tell you what, there's a world of difference between a internet communication system that's just a few years old and something like Zoom or Teams or something that we're using today. The quality of sound is so much better.
Oh yeah,
on the newer software.
Yeah, and I think that is we're at the tip of the iceberg. I'm considering doing some things in our office. We've got some old computer screens, some old computers that aren't being used, and making them sort of like Windows, so that they're available quickly to be turned on to have a quick meeting with multiple people across multiple people in different locations. That used to be an extremely expensive item that maybe you would see in a movie about the president talking about to somebody through their video conferencing and making it secure. Well, Teams is encrypted and We've got technology available to us kind of happenstance and accidentally that is better than what the president had 10 years ago, by far.
I think that's pretty cool.
And we're about out of time for this hour.
We are, about for the first hour, right.
So if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually, as I said at the beginning of the episode, we do give personalized fiduciary investment advice to high net worth people. And we can do that through video conference or telephone, very rarely at great distance in person. So the idea here is we're trying to practice what we preach. The way to get a hold of us, you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. There's contact forms there. We've got email, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go old school and actually use a telephone. You want to give the local number?
It's 254-947-1111. That 1111 was so I could remember the number.
Right. And now, really old school, implying that you actually have a landline. We also have a toll-free number of 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can, like I said, go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, tpwc.com. We've got podcasts going back quite a long ways, years and years. We've got newsletters going back years and years. And you can read our philosophy. Until next hour.